Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com. Or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Good morning. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and the program is called The Naturalist. And this is Bernie Wides, and my partner, my usual partner, Carol, is probably about 4,000 miles from here by now. She's on her way to the Galapagos Islands. So I asked my friend Saul to come and fill in. And Saul, say hi to everybody.
Hello, everyone.
Okay, so Saul is a friend, been a friend for years. We actually met up in way up in Canada when Saul was fishing. And I said, how are you doing? And we found out that Saul lives in Riverdale and I lived in the city. And we were in Algonquin National Park, I think it was.
That's right.
Yeah, which is way out in the woods in Canada. Great place. So anyhow, Saul is the president of the Hudson River Audubon. And he writes a column for them. Is it a monthly column you do, Saul?
We publish eight times a year.
Eight times a year. Okay, so one of Saul's favorite topics is evolution and all the issues associated with it. And I remember Saul came on our show, maybe it was 2 years ago, and so you mentioned about countries, a standing of countries who believe in evolution and who don't. Has that changed any? Do you know?
I don't think it changes. In fact, that's one of the reasons I wanted to come back and talk about evolution. I think it's very important to try to get the information out to the public. And what I have sitting in front of me is the results of a survey that was done a number of years ago, but I don't think it's changed very much. And it's a survey of 35 countries, including the U.S. And the question of the survey was, do you think evolution is true or false? And, of course, people say yes, no, or I don't know. And out of all of these countries, the United States ranks down at the bottom, one above Turkey. And the results for the United States say that 40% of our people think evolution is true, 40% think it's false, and 20% are not sure. And that contrasts, by the way, with Western Europe and Scandinavian countries. For example, in Denmark, 85% of the population thinks evolution is true. In Sweden, also 85%. France, 80%. Japan, 75%. The UK, 70%. So we are next to last, and I find it sad. After over 150 years after Darwin published his theory of evolution through natural selection, many Americans still think that cavemen rode on dinosaurs. And so that's a major reason why I'm here. And your listeners, by the way, Bernie, if they were listening at the intro, they heard a piece of music called The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky. And I ask that be played, because I think, in a way, it has a lesson. We accept that kind of music now, 100 years after it was first premiered. In 1913, The Rite of Spring ballet was done in Paris, and that music, that atonal music by Stravinsky, created such a stir that the public began throwing things at the dancers and the orchestra. Stravinsky had to run away. He literally climbed out a window of the theater and ran back to his house. He was afraid he would get beat up. 100 years later, it's great music. Sadly, I'm waiting. I'm waiting for Darwin's theory of evolution to be as readily accepted as the Rite of Spring.
Yeah, well, Saul, I don't know if we'll both live that long.
Well,
to see it.
You know, when Darwin wrote his book, he expected a firestorm, and he got it. He was accused of telling people that men came from monkeys, which, of course, is not true. That's not what he said. He was accused of going against God's law. People, and we still hear this today. People criticized the theory, saying, "How could you get complex structures? How could you get the formation of an eye, for example? Because all the parts have to work together." Well, we know that eyes have evolved from simple structures into more complicated structures, and scientists have shown how that can happen. The octopus has an eye very similar to ours, and you can trace through organisms that live today how a photosensitive cell starts out and becomes more complicated, and as evolution often does, co-opts a structure that was being used for something else and now puts it in. And people have figured out how something as complicated even as the eye can form.
Yes, so all this, you know, your title of it is The Theory of Evolution, right?
Yeah, well...
Okay,
well,
why don't you dwell on that for a second?
Tell people
the difference between the theory and...
Yeah, well, people say, oh, it's just a theory. Why should we believe it if it's just a theory?
Yeah.
Well, a theory in science doesn't mean what it means to non-scientists. It's not a hunch. It's not just something that somebody comes up in a dream. It's an explanation that's backed by abundant observation, where gaps in knowledge are not seen as grounds for doubt, but rather points for future understanding. That's what a theory is. Darwin's theory of how new species form holds in the same way that Newton's theory of gravitation holds. When we throw a ball up in the air, it always comes down. It doesn't keep flying. So we know about gravity. We experience it all the time. And by the way, when we look at life, we see evolution occurring. All of that diversity from a common ancestor almost 4 billion years ago through a process of mutation and natural selection. Everything points to it. Newton's ideas on gravity, by the way, don't hold at the subatomic level. That's why physicists had to invent quantum mechanics. But Darwin's scheme of evolution through natural selection, nobody's found an exception to it. 150 years later, there is nothing in biology that we see that is outside of his theory. It survives 150 years of scientific scrutiny. Now, until Darwin published his theory, most people thought that the number of species on the planet was immutable. It never changed. Since the Earth was created, as described in Genesis, God made all of these organisms, all these animals, and on the last day he made humans. Actually, the sixth day, the last day he rested, of course. And a major reason that people thought that was that, well, that was the explanation, what we saw in the Bible. It's pretty hard to see species forming, new species forming. It's kind of like watching grass grow. Worse than that, it can take hundreds, if not thousands, of human generations. Darwin himself thought that it should take millions of years to form a new species. And in many cases, that's true. But scientists now have many examples where they see it occurring much faster than that. And that's what I wanted to focus on today. You know, when I was here 2 years ago, I talked a lot about evolution and many of its aspects, but we didn't talk about what's called speciation. The formation of new species, and I think that deserves a program of its own.
Yeah, so That's happening today. It's happening all the time.
Happening, yes.
I think we should emphasize that it's happening all the time.
It happens in front of our very eyes, but right. Most people don't know what to look for. They don't know how to find it, but evolutionary scientists do look, and they do find it. But first, let's make sure we know what we're talking about. Let's define a species. A species, a simple explanation is it's a freely interbreeding population of organisms that produces viable, meaning live, living, and fertile, young. A simpler way of putting it is, if you and I can get together and make babies, and those babies can also make babies, then we are in the same species. What is not a species? A common example of something that's not a species is the mule. The mule is a hybrid. It's a cross between a donkey, an ass, and a horse. And mules can't make new mules. They're sterile. And so a mule is not a species. Now, how do new species form? Well, Darwin said they form when a group of organisms get separated, when a portion of the group separates from the rest. And that separation is usually something physical. A mountain range forms, a lake forms. Bernie and I were talking about two squirrels, yeah, species.
The Grand Canyon squirrels.
Yes.
Yes, like when I was out doing this geology trip at the Grand Canyon many years ago, there was two distinct populations of squirrels. One population lived on the north rim of the Grand Canyon, and one population lived on the south rim. If you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, you know between the two rims is the canyon. And the canyon in places is, what's it, is a mile deep? At least a mile deep.
Yes.
So it's almost an impenetrable barrier for these squirrel populations to mix and breed. So it happened through isolation of many, many years. We don't know how many years. These two became distinct species because now they can't breed with each other.
Right, and the reason they can't breed has to do with probably some physical change. Perhaps the genitals have changed. Courtship has changed, so they don't recognize each other as mates. Or maybe they breed at a slightly different time. So they just don't recognize or can't breed together. They don't recognize each other as mates, or they can't breed together. And this type of speciation, where one group splits off from another and goes its own way, has a fancy name in biology. It's called allopatric speciation.
Mm-hmm.
And all it means is living separately. That's a fancy way to say living in different places. And it's easy for us to imagine how that could happen. We just gave a scenario for, I think it's called the Kaibab squirrel.
Right, the Kaibab.
But another way for two species to form from one can occur even though they still live in the same place. And that's called sympatric speciation.
It has nothing to do with St. Patrick's Day, though.
No, sympatric.
Oh,
no,
sympatric.
That's sympatric.
Oh, okay.
And again, that's a fancy way of saying living in the same place. So that's not as easy to conceive for us, and it's not so easy for scientists to find examples of that either. But lately they have found that also. And so, as we said, of course, speciation is occurring all the time, and sometimes we see the end result and we can deduce what has happened. Other times we can actually watch it unfold. And I'm going to give examples of both of those, unfolding before our eyes, so to speak. And so what are some examples of speciation? I brought a few here today.
Yeah, excuse me, Saul. Folks, when Saul is talking about this, we have illustrations of a lot of these things. So when you finish listening to us today, or whenever you listen on your iPod or iPad or whatever, take a look at these illustrations that Saul has brought in, which tell the story. Okay, so we have Carlos, is that the 1 minute sign for the break? Okay, so we have 1 minute before we take our first break, so we're going to do it in two breaks.
Okay.
Okay, so just sort of leave us with a cliffhanger about Al Patrick. Oh. And the example is the
is Simpatrick.
Simpatrick, right.
Living together. Mm-hmm. And these are fish called the three-spined stickleback.
Oh, the sticklebacks, right.
Three-spined stickleback. Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah.
And
you'll have a new species.
And there are lots of new species of three-spine sticklebacks, which have to do with the formation of lakes as the glaciers receded about 12,000 years ago in America and formed all these new lakes ready to be colonized by organisms that happened to get there by chance. Chance plays a big role in evolution. That's another reason people don't like the idea of evolution through natural selection, because a lot of what's going on is simply chance. But these fish managed to get into these from coastal waters. They managed to invade the shallow glacial lakes. And in the coastal waters, they have body armor. They have very tough scales with spines. They have two spines on the back, dorsal spines, and one on the belly, ventral spines. And once they invaded these lakes, they lost a lot of this body armor, and they lost the ventral spine. And I guess we can talk about why when we come back.
Yeah. So, Carlos, shall we take a break now? Is this a good time? Yeah. Okay. The music is coming back on. Remember, this is called The Rites of Spring. It's a terrific ballet if you ever get a chance to see it. And as Saul said, he was ostracized 100 years ago, and now he's considered a great musician. So, it's over 100 years that Darwin has his theory already. It's time for people to recognize that's the way things are and that's the way it goes. So we'll be back in a minute, take a little break, and Saul's going to continue the story. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, and my guest today is Saul Scheinbach, who is, I can't say replacing Carol, because Carol's cuter, Saul, I have to say that.
But I'm taller, right?
You're taller, right. And Carol's on her way to the Galapagos Islands. That's a trip of a lifetime. If you ever get a chance to go before it's ruined. And by ruined, I mean it's going to be overrun by tourism. Even though the governments control everything, there's so much pressure to let more and more people come that it may be ruined. So we're going to continue talking about these two kinds of speciation, Allopatric and Simpatrick. Simpatrick, okay. So Saul, why don't you take it over from here?
All right. When we took the break, I mentioned that many people have a problem with evolution because of the role of chance it plays. And I want to elaborate on that. Why so many people have difficulty with Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection. And I think it has to do with what science has shown us overall. We're very egocentric, and we want to think that we are the center of the universe. And you may recall that 500 years ago, Copernicus, along with the observations that Galileo made, showed us we're not the center of the universe. We're merely revolving around the sun, and it's not the reverse, the sun revolving around us. So that was humbling, and people didn't like that, but they had to accept it, although you may also recall that the church did a few nasty things to Galileo, and it was only 500 years later that they actually apologized. So we've been faced with what science has been telling us for the past 500 years. We are not so special, and Darwin came along 150 years ago and said, you know, we're not specially created. We evolved through a process that he called natural selection. Then Freud showed us that we're not even conscious often of what drives us to act in certain ways. And I could go on with that. We've learned in recent years that we're not special. We're not the only animals that have speech. We're not the only animals that are altruistic.
Or tool using.
Tool using. Culture, passing what we learn on to the next generation. There are lots of animals that do that also. In terms of genetics, we're not so special either. We have about 23,000 genes. But that was surprising, by the way, when the human genome was sequenced about 10 years ago. We found that we don't have as many genes as we thought. In fact, we have just about as many as a chicken, and fewer than corn, which has 32,000. So, we're just not special, and Darwin's theory is at the core of that, and I think that's why people resist to such a great degree. They all want to think that they're special.
Yeah. Well, so I think it has a lot to do with religion. Because all the religions say that the God or some godlike being created the universe, and if we look at the way Darwin said, everything was through chance. There was a chance played a big part. If you look at the branches of the tree of life, and we ended up on a branch that eventually became human. That branch could have withered away and died, and we may have never evolved in the form that we are now.
That's right. In Darwin's theory of natural selection, God doesn't have to play any role at all. And Darwin knew that. And that's why he sat on his discoveries and his ideas for over 20 years. He knew the uproar it would cause. And Bernie, as you mentioned just earlier to me, his wife was a religious woman, and he was he really wrestled with himself before he actually published this theory.
Mm-hmm. I think his father was a missionary or a minister, wasn't he?
He comes from an illustrious family. Yeah. His grandfather was some kind of a minister and also a famous botanist.
Yeah,
and did a lot of studies and experiments in botany.
Yeah, was that Erasmus?
Erasmus Darwin, I believe.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the Huxleys. He was part of the Huxley
family
too.
Yeah. Well, right. Huxley was his contemporary.
Right.
The Huxleys are a genius family. You know, we've got. Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, and Thomas Huxley was a contemporary of Darwin's, and he saw very quickly what a great idea this was. In fact, any great idea in science, when it comes out, is usually simple. That is, other scientists see it right away as a simple thing that explains so many complicated problems. And that's what Huxley said. When he read Darwin's book, he said, why didn't I think of that?
Right.
And that happens so often in science. You know, the discovery that DNA is the genetic material. Scientists were wrestling with that in the 40s, 1940s. Many people thought that protein had to be the molecule, the chemical that was the genetic stuff because it was so complex. And when Watson and Crick published their earth-shaking paper in 1951, all of the other scientists said, my goodness, this is so simple, so elegant. Why didn't I think of that?
Mm-hmm.
But it was Watson and Crick who came up with it. So every great idea in science is relatively simple. That's what makes it great. And it pulls together all of the questions, it answers all of these questions that people have about what seem to be complex problems. It explains them in one fell swoop. And that's what natural selection did.
Yes, and I think the word they like to use is elegant.
That's right, elegant. Elegant is the word. It's really, when someone publishes a paper like that, it's really like a work of art. You know, there isn't a lot of difference between art and science. Many people think there is, but the way that Watson and Crick came about this discovery, for example, that DNA is genetic material, and the paper that they published in the magazine Nature in 1951, it was just an elegant work, a piece of art. The way they wrote about it and described it. It was a creation of theirs, just like a painting is a creation of an artist. Some people often say, oh, well, in science, things are waiting, just waiting out there to be discovered. You know, you kick over a rock and you find something. That's true, but then what do you do with what you found? You know, how do you devise experiments to answer the questions about what you found and convince others who were skeptical, as always, scientists are skeptics, convince others that this idea that you have is really true, and Watson and Crick did that. There was no argument after that. That was it. DNA is the genetic material, period.
Hmm.
But let's go back to the three-spined stickleback.
Oh,
that,
yes.
That fish. Yeah,
we left that fish.
We kind of forgot him.
We left him floundering around in the glacial
lakes.
Yeah.
So these fish invaded this newly opened territory about 12,000 years ago when these lakes were formed, and they lost this spine on their belly, and it turns out that this body armor with this ventral spine was good when they were in the coastal waters to keep predators from grabbing them, but in these lakes there are the larva of dragonflies, and dragonflies are pretty nasty. The larva, the adult dragonfly is a beautiful flying insect. It's been around for 100 million years. One time it was much bigger too, and it eats a lot of mosquitoes. It eats a lot of other insects. It's very helpful. But the larvae live in lakes, and they change. They metamorphose into adults and come out of the water. But while they're larvae, they eat other things. They grab onto other things, even small fish, like the stickleback. And this ventral spine turned out to be a disadvantage for the stickleback. It was something that the dragonfly larva could grab onto. And so, you know, if you know anything about Darwin's theory of natural selection, if you get a mutation in a fish so that fish doesn't produce the ventral spine as it develops as an embryo, that fish is more likely to survive, not get caught by the dragonfly larva, and pass that mutation on to its children, and pretty soon you have populations in the lakes that don't have that ventral spine.
So that's natural selection.
That's natural selection forming dozens of species that now lack this ventral spine in all of these lakes, because remember they're in separate lakes, and we said in speciation, if we get separation, some kind of physical barrier like a mountain range or the Grand Canyon or living in a lake that has no connection to other lakes, each one of these fish goes off and forms adaptations on its own. And so that's what's happened to the three-spined stickleback. Let's go to another example I have here. The European corn borer. What is that?
One minute.
Okay. The European corn borer is a moth. that split into two. Mm-hmm. And the caterpillar of the moth used to live on corn, but now some of them prefer to eat mugwort or hops. Hops, the stuff you make beer out of. And in the wild, they mate with their own group. So what does that mean? It means right now, if you go out in the wild and you capture a female moth, she's carrying around the sperm package of the moth that grows, that lives on the plant that she grew on. And so that they're not mating with each other. They're forming two separate species, two species of European corn borer.
And one is just is eating the mugwort now.
One is eating mugwort and the other is eating the corn. And scientists call that assortative mating.
Another great word.
Assortative means they're sorting. Assortative mating due to microhabitat preference.
Oh.
Fancy way of describing what I just said.
Right. They've switched their food supply.
That's right. So they don't live on the same plant.
But they live in the same areas.
Right. And of course, the moths can fly. So right. You might think that they're still interbreeding, but they're not.
No, because of those subtle changes.
Yes.
And also, I guess it's not so subtle change if they have a new food supply.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. I think we have about another minute left. So
okay.
First part of the show. So why don't you go continue.
All right, well, we'll give you another example. Salmon, sockeye salmon, they were stocked. You know, salmon is a great food. People love to eat salmon. And so about 50 years ago, sockeyes were put into Lake Washington in the state of Washington. What ended up happening was some of these salmon moved into the river that feeds the lake. And it didn't take very long. After 50 years, which is about 14 generations of fish, there are now fish living that stay in the river, in the current, that are more slender. The males are more slender. Why? Because they do a courtship behavior where they have to turn sideways in the current. And if they didn't get skinnier, thinner, they would get washed away. The females in the river are bigger than the ones that stay in the lake because they need to fight the current to dig a deeper nest to put their eggs in and keep the eggs from sweeping away.
Hmm.
And if you do a genetic analysis on the DNA of these fish, you see that there are two populations, one that lives in the lake, one that lives in the river, and they're not interbreeding, even when they see each other, even when they encounter each other. So one species is splitting into two after only 50 years.
And that's a pretty fast change.
That's right. You know, I always wondered about this. When I took evolution when I was in college, it talked about millions of years and millions of years. But, you know, a mutation occurs in an individual, and it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And if that mutation get passed on, well, why should it take millions of years? And we see that it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It's a fluid process, a dynamic process, and maybe one species splits into two and then perhaps reunites again to form one, splits off again, branches. You can have all sorts of scenarios. But certainly, it doesn't have to take millions of years. It can take a very short time, even in our lifetime. And I'll have other examples of that as we go along.
Yeah, well, you know, I could see that happening between the Republicans and the Democrats.
What do you see?
I see that they don't get along with each other anymore. They probably eat different foods, and they have different lifestyles. So who knows? Maybe in another few years, they'll genetically be different.
Well, I think they're already speaking two different languages.
I think you're right. See that? The culture is changing.
That's right.
And the culture could be changing as the result of genetics. Who knows?
Yes.
We don't know that. So with that fancy idea. We hear that great music coming up, The Rites of Spring, and this is the end of this show. I want to thank Saul for coming down today and giving this great introduction to genetics and reminding us about Darwin's great work and some of the other great scientists. And we're going to do another show on it that will shed more light on other critters? All
we have more examples of speciation.
More examples of speciation, and I find this really fascinating, especially if you can look on the pictures on the site. You'll see pictures of some of these critters. So, Carlos, is that the are we running out of time for the first show? Should be just about the end, right? Okay, so we're going to wrap up the first show, and who knows, maybe between the first show and the second show, we'll see another example of a speciation.
Could be.
Right here in the studio, you never can tell. So keep your eyes open.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.